Welcome back to Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. It's called backpack funding. That's the idea that parents of Utah's public school students should be able to take the tax dollars set aside for their children's education and be able to spend it on their individual needs. That concept is at the heart of SB 65, a bill Utah lawmakers passed this year that allows students to choose from a variety of online courses and pay for them with public dollars. Its critics say it takes away much-needed funding from traditional K-12 schools and is little more than a backdoor voucher bill. Its supporters, like my next guest, say it puts the focus on students, not systems. Judy Clark is the executive director of Parents for Choice in Education, and she joins me in the studio this morning. Judy, it's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, give us a call to join us on the air. Do you support this concept of backpack funding? Is innovation the key to improving educational outcomes in Utah? Join us on the air at 801-355-8255, 801-355-TALK. Judy, did Senate Bill 65 start with your organization?
We did. This is a concept that we've been working on for the last several years. We're talking about students who are digital natives, and online learning is the perfect complement to help them reach their academic goals.
And so tell me about how this increases the online education options for students in Utah.
Well, right now, if you want to do online learning, you really have to do all or nothing. You can be enrolled in online high school and take all of your courses, or you have to kind of decide to do traditional bricks and mortar. We have had electronic high school, which has been around for more than a decade, but it was really designed for credit recovery. So the courses aren't really set up to be rich in quality and really for student mastery. I mean, when you look at the idea of courses, do I want something that's going to properly prepare me, or am I looking for something that's just going to help me graduate? And that's kind of the difference between online courses. So SB 65, which is the statewide online program, students are going to be able to pre-enroll right now for courses this fall. They'll be able to customize their schedule and create a blended learning environment where they'll be still enrolled in their bricks and mortar school, you know, for up to six periods or seven periods. They could just take one course if they wanted. And then they'll be able to choose an online course from multiple online course providers.
And so why do you think the state needed to increase the online education options for students when you noted the electronic high school? There's also two online charter schools we have right now. Some school districts offer their own individual online schools as well. So how does this improve upon that situation?
Well, I think you really hit it on the head. We have schools that are online, but we're really looking for something that's going to allow them to customize. You know, going completely online may not be a right fit for all students. So we need to allow them to do things a la carte, to customize it for their individual needs, whether that is about a particular course that may not be available to them, or perhaps they just need to free up some time because the courses that they do want to take are only available in certain periods of their day, and so they're not able to take every course that they would like because there are scheduling confinements from their traditional bricks and mortar. Or perhaps they you know, want some more flexibility because they're doing an internship or some other study work programs, and they need to free up some time, or they would just like to actually take some courses where they can do their work at their own pace. You know, online learning actually provides like a one-on-one tutoring environment when it comes to courses because it's based on you individually. You don't have to hope that you are progressing at the same pace as your entire class. It's when you do it, you know, when you want it, how you want it. So if you feel like your peak learning hours are at 5 a.m., good for you. Get up, get started, and you'll have resources available. Or if you like to kind of break up your day and think, you know what, I'm really alert. I feel like I'm rested, so I want to do some work around 5 or 6. Online learning provides that flexibility.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. My guest is Judy Clark, Executive Director of Parents for Choice in Education. Now, Judy, as you know, the controversy that this bill generated was specifically surrounding this idea that not just public school districts would be able to provide online courses, but private companies as well. So under the final version of SB 65 that was passed out of the legislature, will private companies be able to provide course instruction?
The statewide online program provides for authorized providers, which are LEAs. So a state-approved entity like the state, like Electronic High School, could be a provider, although it is not this first year. And then charter schools or districts who have a fully dedicated online program. I mean, online learning isn't something that I can just pick up like you know, a game of cards and suddenly say, oh, I've taught forever and I'm just going to all of a sudden do this. You want to make sure that the nuances of online learning are in place so that we're properly preparing our students. So we actually have quite a few providers, but they are all entities who are public school providers now.
Mm-hmm. At one point, though, I understand the bill did include private providers. Talk about that. Should that be an option down the road, do you think?
We really wanted to provide an avenue so that some of the, you know, great companies, we have private providers now, mm-hmm. who provide education in our public school system. When you think about like a company like Imagine Learning, they're amazing. They've done phenomenal work with our English language learners and our special ed sort of kids. They're a private provider. They actually get $2.7 million in appropriations each year, and we don't seem to have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. We wanted to create an avenue where a company that was really great at online learning could go to the state board, say, this is the service. We're confident that we can do this. We're accredited. We're going to meet the criteria that you set so that we can be qualified to be part of the public education system. So it wasn't really about private providers. It was really about providing a breadth of options for our students. And we didn't want to eliminate any of the great providers that we use now or that may come along.
Mm-hmm. Now, Judy, as you know, the critics of this bill said this overall concept of let the funding follow the student was the same argument that was made during the voucher debate. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think it's funny that we still hear the word voucher. We're so many years down the road, and that is not a concept that anyone's really pursuing. But I think opponents to innovation and reform really bring up that word because they feel like it brings up this feeling of uncertainty and doubt and, ooh, what could be going on? But, I mean, something like that really only works when we're really actually talking about something like a voucher. I think the discussion in education funding continues to turn to the fact that we dedicate our tax dollars for students, mm-hmm. not necessarily for one particular system. And when you hear, well, it would hurt our public schools or it would do this, I get frustrated because we're really talking about students. We're talking about public school students, and we're talking about public school students wanting to take advantage of public options. At what mm-hmm. point do we say, okay, this is for the kids rather than this is for the adults?
Mm-hmm. This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. We're speaking with Judy Clark, Executive Director of Parents for Choice in Education. You can join us on the air at 801-355-8255. So, Judy, let's talk about the measures that are in place in this bill to ensure that students who are taking advantage of these online options actually succeed. What are the measures to ensure that, one, the providers are qualified to do so, and, two, that students who start an online course actually follow through with it?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you. And it brings up a really big sort of paradigm shift about SB 65. Mm-hmm. So let me first address the easy one that says, are these providers qualified to teach our kids? And the simple answer is yes, they're already doing it. Mm-hmm. We're talking about charters. We're talking about districts that have all of the accountability and responsibility to the state office and to the state to ensure that there is proper oversight mm-hmm. and that they are meeting goals. When you talk about, you know, what is there to ensure that students who enroll will continue to succeed is that a portion of the funding is given to the provider upon successful enrollment, and there's a process for that. Mm-hmm. But we don't pay the remaining balance until the student successfully completes the course. Right now, when it comes to our other public school options, if a student enrolls in a charter school, they get the money. If a student enrolls in the district, they get the money. And we just kind of cross our fingers and hope that they do well. And at the end of the year, then I guess we'll figure out. With the statewide online education program, we are only going to fully fund courses if the student successfully completes the course.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't, the money will go back into the uniform school fund. So no money's lost, but we've really incentivized these providers to ensure that they properly help the students all along the way until their successful completion.
Judy, another bill your organization supported during the legislative session was Senator Wayne Niederhauser's school grading bill, modeled after the system in Florida, where public schools actually receive an A through an F based on their performance year to year. Those grades are sent home to the parents. What do you think will be the outcome of this legislation?
Well, I'm really excited about it, because what I think is that we're going to suddenly start to understand how our schools are doing. I think every year we kind of maybe think we have an idea of when AYP comes out. It kind of is sometime in the fall, right? That's what most people say. Mm-hmm. And if you're to say, what does it mean to make AYP? And they'll say, well, I don't really know. And those who do know say, well, AYP stands for Adequate Year Progress, so it must mean that we're doing something. And people don't really have an idea of what that means. They have no context for what is involved in that process and how that reflects on their school or how their school is actually doing to maybe another school that's, you know, relatively close to their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So the school grading system is, I think, genius because it's going to really help parents and community members to understand how their local school is. You know, we constantly hear we need parents to be more involved in schools. We need business leaders to be more involved in schools. You know, these schools, they need help. They need all of these, but they need resources. And we leave that as kind of a vague concept. Meanwhile, parents are thinking, well, I think my school's pretty good. It's those schools over there. Yet we have no idea. You know, the state actually has a very comprehensive accountability plan that is extremely complex to navigate and then digest once you actually get to your school, because you don't know is my progress score of 183 good? What's the high? I mean, I have no context for that at all. Mm-hmm. But if I suddenly find out that my school is getting a B, then it's like, okay, I kind of get that. The school grading will also provide a very clear explanation of how those grades are calculated. And unlike some of the other accountability systems, it's not just about students who are proficient, mm-hmm. according to state standards. We're actually going to give credit to those schools who are making progress with those who are not proficient. Because we do have a growing demographic shift in our state. And when I hear, what about the schools that aren't making AYP? Those teachers are working so hard. The kids are working so hard. But they may be one, two, or even three grade levels behind. And it can be really frustrating, even though they're not proficient, to not be recognized for the progress that they're making. And the school grading system will recognize that process.
Those who voted against this bill labeled it as an unfunded mandate, saying, for example, let's say a school gets a C or a D, well, that doesn't automatically provide more resources for the school to help improve. What do you think about that argument?
Well, this is really just about getting an idea of where we are. Mm-hmm. It's actually taking the data that we currently have, and it's aggregating it in a way that it's easy for people to understand. Then we're going to allow them the flexibility to figure out what's going to work for their school. When you talk about unfunded mandates, you think about a huge checklist of things that must be completed in order to change that. And the school grading system isn't like that. It's going to say, we have taken a look at your student outcomes and the progress, and this is where you're ranking. Now, we're going to empower you at the local school level with your school community council, with your parents, with your teachers, to find ways to correct that. And we're not going to penalize you for that. But we want to provide this easy way for people to understand so that they can be empowered to get engaged.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. My guest is Judy Clark, Executive Director of Parents for Choice in Education. You can join us on air with your questions and comments at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Judy, there's a big debate going on right now over the state school board and the election process. Right now, there's a much criticized process whereby there's a vetting committee and the governor picks who goes on the ballot. Even Governor Herbert himself has said that it lends itself to politicization and he doesn't care for it. There were two measures during the session to create direct school board elections, one that would have nonpartisan elections, the other that would create partisan elections where, just like if I were running for the legislature, I would go through the Republican or the Democratic county convention and state convention process. Which method did your organization support?
We actually didn't take a position on those bills, but it's something that we work really closely on. We do try and be a resource for the community when it comes to elections and especially on education issues, mm-hmm. so that they kind of know what to ask or how to engage. And I think the state school board race, I often call it the most neglected race in the state. Mm-hmm. We're talking about 15 school board members, so their districts are twice as large as a state Senate mm-hmm. district, and it is nonpartisan. So many times you don't see debates that are held so that people can really get to know the candidates. And there's also the side that I hear all the time. People call me and they say, I tried calling the candidates and I asked them how they feel about this or that. And they just kind of shut me down and they said, well, this is a nonpartisan election, so that's not an issue. I think one of the greatest fallacies that we hear when it comes to state school board races or in education in general, that politics don't belong in education. And that's simply not true. I mean, we're talking about the largest portion of the state budget. Politics play a role in education because the principles behind a political view come into play when you're talking about enacting law and how we spend money and how we budget money.
But that raises the question to me is, if you have candidates going through the convention system, whether it's Republican or Democratic, don't you worry that candidates would be running on a platform of, oh, you should vote for me because I'm the most conservative, you should vote for me because I'm the most liberal, and trying to convince the delegates that they're conservative or liberal, does that really what we want for the school board?
What I would really like to see is that people feel like they can get to know their school board candidates a lot more. And there be a forum that they can get into the nitty-gritty issues and say, you know, how do you feel about this? Whether it is curriculum or class schedules or innovation or whether we push local control, whether we allow more autonomy and flexibility at a local school level or not. Some of those issues are really hard for people to engage because that's just a race that kind of happens on its own. Many times it's won by the person who has the alphabetical advantage.
Let's talk about a specific bill during the legislative session that was opposed by the Utah Education Association. It's something that we're seeing not just in Utah, but other states as well. And that is this idea that school districts should not be allowed to use a policy based on seniority when it comes to layoffs. If they need to lay off people, they should look at the most qualified teachers. They should not simply say, you've been here the longest, you get to stay. You were just hired last year. You have to go. So the legislature passed a bill that prohibits this so-called last hired, first fired rule. What do you think this means for public education in Utah?
Well, I think it's really great news. I think it's great news for parents. I think it's great news for students. And I think it's really great news for administrators and principals. The idea that we would evaluate the need for staff based on who has been there longest rather than who is being the most effective is very, very sad and frustrating. I mean, if I'm a parent in a school and I find out that there is a great teacher, she's taught there just a couple years, and she's phenomenal. She has not only well-liked, but is really serving the students and they're excelling. The fact that she might be let go before someone who's been there for 25 years, just because she's been there for 25 years, based solely on that, not necessarily comparing their teacher effectiveness, but based on seniority, is it damages our students' education.
Should individual schools be able to determine for themselves, or individual districts maybe, what constitutes effectiveness, whether it's, you know, higher test scores or better outcomes or that sort of thing?
Well, it's interesting that you bring this up because I had quite a few discussions with members from the State Office of Education and districts. I think teacher effectiveness is something that we see discussed a little bit each year, and it's kind of growing momentum. I know from the education establishment, or I could say from the administration kind of at the state level, they feel like the only way for it to be fair is for it to be universal. Because otherwise, one school standard might be different than another. So a teacher who wasn't cutting the mustard at one school could easily just go to another. And they said that that might encourage the idea of dancing of the lemons, where you have one bad teacher and they could just kind of dance around from each school. I understand their concern. Obviously, we don't want bad teachers moving from one school to the next. I would hope that there would be other precautions about that. But I also am a firm believer that different schools have different demographics and they may have different goals. And so while ensuring that we don't have bad teachers that are passing around, I do think we need to empower the principals and the local leadership at a school more with the ability to focus what they're looking for in a teacher based on their particular student demographics and school goals. I mean, we actually have school improvement plans. Not many people know that. But, you know, if they have a school improvement plan that really says we want to encourage a huge increase in our reading ready levels, I would love for them to feel like they can hire teachers who are excellent in that area because it meets their improvement plan.
Judy, going back to the state school board, there were two very interesting constitutional amendments considered during this session that ultimately didn't pass but may be brought back for further debate. There's one that, sponsored by former Senator Butters now, that would have the state school board be accountable to laws passed by the legislature. There's another one that would actually do away with the school board altogether and put the governor in charge of public education. Where did your organization weigh in on these ideas?
Those were very innovative ideas. We didn't necessarily take a position on those as well. I think what we're looking for when it comes to our state school board and our state superintendent is a mechanism that people can really engage with that and feel like their members can be responsive and that they can engage with them and understand where they stand on issues. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about already with state school board elections and whether they should be partisan or not. I think that is circling all around the same idea, that we're looking for someone to be accountable for our public education system. And it can't be this cloud that we don't really know who's in it or how it works or how long they've been there or where they stand on issues. We need real transparent accountability for those people who are really directing our students' education. So whether that's under the governor or whether that is, partisan elections, there probably needs to be a change that empowers our community to be more involved in that process.
And finally, Judy, looking more nationally here, there's been a lot of scrutiny lately. Certainly we've seen in Wisconsin and other states of public school teachers and of teachers' unions. Why do you think that is from your perspective?
Well, I think we are getting a lot more engaged in education and we're starting to realize that what we thought was this touchy-feely, fuzzy, book club almost for teachers is actually an extremely powerful union. And I don't begrudge anyone the opportunity to belong in a union, but we have to recognize that their sole interest is in protecting their members. I think for a long time in Utah we thought, oh, it's for the kids. But no, it's not. I mean, the UEA is a organization that advocates for its members. And sometimes that is in conflict with what we would like to see for our students.
At the same time, though, teaching is a really important job, but not necessarily a glamorous one. I mean, I know for a fact I could not cut it as a teacher.
Me too. I have the utmost respect.
and I never would be able to do it myself. Doesn't there need to be an organization, a strong organization, that protects their rights?
Well, that's, I guess, the question begs, are they under attack? I mean, I think we've seen record increases in education spending for our state over the last decade. The legislature has given, new teacher pay increases. We've held strong with our WPU. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're saying that someone needs protection, I guess the question is, are they under attack? And I don't think great teachers are under attack.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to a union, a lot of times they're about protecting the entrenched teachers who have been there for a long time. Many of our new teachers actually aren't even joining the union. I think this next generation of teachers see no value in that. They want to be the masters of their own destiny. They know that they are quality. They know that they have a marketable skill that they can really find gainful employment in a competitive environment.
Mm-hmm. And that goes on to the issue, I think, of merit pay, of ensuring that, quality teachers are being compensated more. Where are we at with this issue in Utah? I know there was a pilot project a couple years ago. Where's that at right now?
I think we're about to see the results of the merit pay during this interim. I think Superintendent Minlove, I could be misquoting, but I'm quite certain he said that we would start to see those results here. And I know that is something that Senator Adams was very outspoken about during this last legislative session, that he would like to see us moving in that direction. And looking at the results from those pilot programs, I think it's there are several pilot programs that we're working, but we actually have several charters within our state who do performance pay as part of their regular compensation now that aren't necessarily even part of the pilot program. There's a lot of great ideas out there. It's not as an ambiguous idea as what we like to make of it.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. Our guest in the studio for the past half hour has been Judy Clark. She's the Executive Director of Parents for Choice in Education. Judy, it's been good to have you.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back.